On April 26, 1986, an uncontrolled nuclear chain reaction blew a hole in the roof of Chernobyl's reactor number 4. The explosion and subsequent fires released huge amounts of radioactive contamination into the atmosphere, blanketing nearby towns in Ukraine and Belarus, before eventually spreading across Europe. And what is still considered the worst nuclear accident in history can be chalked up to a series of human errors and poor judgment. For one, the Soviets built the reactor using a flawed design, which scientists were aware of well before the accident. The operators didn't fully understand how the reactor worked or what the safety protocols were. And on the night of the accident, Soviet officials ignored signs that the reactor had become unstable and kept going with the scheduled operations. Had the government addressed these issues, they probably could have averted this disaster. 25 years later, in March 2011, a giant tsunami triggered by an earthquake swamped the Fukushima reactor in northern Japan. While the reactors safely shut themselves down, the wall of water flooded the backup generators that powered the cooling systems for those reactors, causing them to overheat and partially melt down. The damage and release of radioactive material forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate the area. Many experts agree that this incident could have been prevented entirely if officials hadn't ignored suggestions for improving the safety of the reactor, including studies that showed how a tsunami could flood the plant and shut down those emergency backup generators, which is exactly what happened. Chernobyl and Fukushima are obviously some of the most dramatic examples of nuclear disasters. Major accidents happen across all industries, including other suppliers of energy, like coal and oil. But when we make mistakes with nuclear power, they tend to stand out. I'm Laura Krantz, and this is Wild Thing, Going Nuclear, a series about the power of the universe contained in the tiny little package of the atom.
You and I are living in the atomic age.
The endless debate over harnessing that power.
The mysteries of the universe.
And whether we humans are responsible enough to mess with it.
Of benefit or of destruction. Of good or of evil.
SL1 didn't blow up on its own. Everything that caused that disaster lay squarely in the realm of human error. It was poorly designed and not well maintained. The rods stuck. There were problems with the welds and the metals. And when the men working there reported these problems, officials told them to work around the issues. On top of that, relatively inexperienced young men staffed the reactor. Men who had their own personal problems and made their own mistakes, like pulling control rod 9 out too far. But are all these accidents emblematic of the risks? Because you could argue that we have actually had a pretty good safety record when it comes to nuclear energy.
One of the problems with being as safe as nuclear has been is like accidents haven't been normalized.
Ted Nordhaus is the founder of the Breakthrough Institute, a think tank that focuses on technological solutions to environmental problems.
If nuclear accidents happened as frequently as refinery accidents, we would probably just be like, okay, it happens and there's some cleanup and there's some cost and whatever. And like, as far as anyone can tell, no one died from it and it's okay. But it's just such a rare and exceptional circumstance that kind of when it happens, everyone freaks out.
We'll hear more from Ted in the next episode, but he raises an interesting point that these events are so uncommon, thankfully, that their rarity makes them more alarming. Just how nervous should we be about potential nuclear disasters? Are the risks as bad as we think? And how good are we at assessing those risks?
Think about naturally occurring environments and how we react to the threats and risks that we confront.
Leif Van Boeven is a professor of psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He studies human judgment and decision-making, especially about environmental issues. And he's trying to explain to me how humans think about risks.
Typically what we do is we would notice when something makes us afraid. Something might kind of attract our attention and we start to pay attention to that, and that makes us feel a little bit more afraid of the thing we're paying attention to. And these processes occur really, really fast, and they kind of nudge us to avoid those risks.
The classic example is seeing a lion on the savannah. But let's switch it up and say, Bigfoot in a forest. You're just going about your day, harvesting berries, catching fish, and then you see this big, shadowy creature. Your whole system is wired in such a way that the only thing you're really paying attention to is the danger.
You kind of want to have an overreaction to that and avoid it until you know that it's safe. And so our psychological system is really nicely attuned to those kind of responses. And normally that would be a really, really healthy way to engage with the environment.
And it works really, really well in certain situations. But the modern world poses kind of a problem for us.
The way that we engage with information in the modern environment hijacks some of those naturally occurring processes. And our reactions don't have an opportunity to correct themselves. And so we end up being over afraid of things that we really shouldn't be all that afraid of.
Like, say, a terrorist attack.
And we end up being completely not bothered by risks that are actually really, really dangerous.
Like driving a car. Why is that? Why are we so bad at actually understanding risk?
In reality, what most of us do is we have some quick, often emotional response to these potential threats. And that response directly translates into behavior. The behavior is often just an aversion, like, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not interested in investing in that. It terrifies me. And that's kind of where the conversation stops.
If someone told you about a technology that would reduce carbon emissions, help deal with climate change, and provide abundant amounts of energy, if they laid out the numbers, just the numbers, you would probably think, oh, hey, this looks pretty good. And then you learn that we're talking about nuclear energy.
People say, oh, I don't like that. Why don't I like it? I don't know. But now I can make up some reasons. My gut tells me. And it's not that people are just completely irrational and thoughtless. It's just that the way we naturally respond, the way we're built, is to have that quick emotional response.
We rely on our gut feelings, those emotions that instinctively arise, to form a snap judgment. Is this good or bad? Helpful or harmful? Could it potentially kill me? Of course, many of these feelings are influenced by what we already know, or think we know. And in the case of nuclear power, we almost immediately recall all the bad stuff that's happened.
The scary stories are easy to imagine. Most of us probably don't really know about the details of Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, but we have an emotional response to that. Where does that emotional response come from? It's not because, oh, I watched all the documentaries and read the Wikipedia page, and now here's my valued assessment. It's somehow this has become a thing in culture that is tagged with these negative associations. And I don't know exactly what that means, but it's something scary and uncertain and dreaded. And if it went wrong, it could go really, really wrong. That causes me to have this immediate emotional reaction.
There are good reasons for this emotional response. The story of Chernobyl is the stuff of bad dreams, not to mention all the post-apocalyptic science fiction tales out there. Then there are concerns about health and the environment, and the long-term repercussions of a nuclear meltdown, which, Leaf says, taps into a sort of innate fear we have of contamination.
Again, evolutionarily, this makes a lot of sense. So you really want to be on guard against things that might contaminate the body, things that might contaminate food that you consume, because that can kill you, and it can kill you quickly. And so we have this very strong disgust response that becomes moralized in the context of contamination.
And radioactive contamination conjures up even more fears. What if it gets in the water, in the air, in our DNA, in our children's DNA? If we don't actually understand the underlying principles of a technology, it makes it all the more frightening. And nuclear is definitely one of those things that we may not really understand. We, meaning the general public, I'm pretty sure scientists have a grasp on it.
Most of us just, we don't understand how nuclear really operates. It's outside of our control, and there's some kind of negative storytelling around it. They combine to give us this immediate, strong fear response.
We're living at a time when nuclear energy is a big topic of conversation, but most of us only have a vague understanding of how it works. I'll be the first to cop to this. Until I started doing this project, I had no idea how a reactor functioned. I barely knew what an atom was. Many of you are probably more educated than I was, but I'm betting there are a fair number of you in the same boat. So when someone says nuclear, those gaps in our knowledge get filled in by pop culture, history, and dramatic news stories. It's our evolutionary snap judgment kicking into gear, because this is a risk we don't fully understand. And then, of course, there are also the issues of trust and familiarity. Nuclear energy has been around for over 60 years now, but because most of us aren't really familiar with the technology, we have to trust experts to tell us if it's safe.
This is really what fills me with some dread, because we as a society are losing our shared sources of trust, whether it's media or government or scientists or some set of experts that everyone recognizes is trustworthy in telling us what is dangerous and what is not dangerous.
I mean, the experts haven't always done themselves a lot of favors, given the stories of how waste has been mishandled and other problems in our history. Take, for example, what happened in March of 1979. An accident that most Americans know by name, Three Mile Island. This was a big commercial reactor operated by the Metropolitan Edison Utility Company that experienced what's called a loss of coolant accident. The water used to cool the reactor leaked, and the reactor began to overheat. Historian Natasha Zaretsky details what happened in her book, Radiation Nation.
It took several days to bring the reactor core temperature down. And the fear at the time, which really lasted over several days, was that there would be either an explosion or a full meltdown where you would have kind of massive radiation leaking from the core.
And this didn't happen in the remote desert of Idaho, but in Middletown, Pennsylvania, the middle of a very populated part of the East Coast. Thankfully, the reactor did not melt down. And follow-up studies by both federal and state officials found that very little radiation escaped the plant. From an industry standpoint, this was a huge success. Their safety features had ultimately worked, and they'd averted a potential crisis. But the people in that area felt understandably rattled, in part because they didn't feel officials had given them the full story.
I think that that's the big problem. Like, there's inconsistencies right out of the gate in terms of how serious the accident is. Has radiation leaked from the plant? There's a tremendous amount of confusion that I think creates a climate of distrust from really early on.
At press conferences, officials dodged questions, sometimes because they didn't want to answer them, but also because they didn't want to admit not knowing the answers. They didn't want to panic people unnecessarily, but ultimately, their tactics made people feel less confident.
People had really practical questions. Should I leave my money in my bank account? Do I need to evacuate my home? Will I ever be able to come back? People were calling radio stations. People were calling their doctor's offices. People were calling the governor's offices. They were really trying to get very, very practical, tangible information about what they needed to do. And it's extremely confusing if you feel like you're not getting consistent guidance.
And given the growing body of evidence that radioactive exposure could cause health issues, what people really wanted to know about was the threat to their health. Authorities claimed that very little radiation leaked out.
I mean, there were certainly some people who were willing to accept the official story, but there were also a lot of people in the community who were skeptical. You know, the government might say that radiation emissions from the plant will be so tiny as to have no impact on our health, but can we really believe them?
If you need another example, take a look around at what has happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. The lack of trust in experts is obvious. So if people already have this emotional reaction to the idea of nuclear, can we ever get past that? What makes people change their minds about things they think are risky? Leif Van Boeven again.
Getting over the fear is not impossible, but it will be extremely difficult and will be an uphill battle. And we have to think about addressing people's fears with strategies other than just facts and figures.
Think of all the various reports about climate change, more numbers than you can shake a stick at.
But they don't really carry the emotional sway. They don't really change the stories that people tell in the way that directly impacts them. And I think the same is true with nuclear, that it's become tainted ironically, right? It's the ideas have become weaponized in a sense, and I think in part because they have been tied to weapons historically, and we can't quite get over that thought.
One way we might get over our fears is if we see the benefits that nuclear energy can have. But we're not too keen on building the reactors that could demonstrate this because of our concerns about the risks. So round and round we go. But with this in mind, the companies behind some of the new types of reactors are trying to anticipate these fears.
Everyone has a different perception of risk. Some folks are afraid to fly, and even though it's very safe, but they're willing to drive on a busy highway, which is a higher risk. So perception of risk is key.
Dr. Jose Reyes is the chief technology officer and co-founder of NuScale Power. NuScale is a private company on the leading edge of the next generation of nuclear reactors, specifically small modular reactors. Small because they are considerably smaller than a typical commercial reactor.
What we've designed is a small reactor, which sits inside of a small containment vessel. So instead of the big concrete, the domes that you're familiar with, we've gone to a small steel containment vessel. And that's our module. It's about 76 feet in length and about 15 feet in diameter. It's like a tall cylinder when you look at it.
Imagine a really big soda can. And then, like any good soda, you can get a 4-pack, a 6-pack, or a 12-pack. This is what makes this design modular.
We have the 12-pack, the 6-pack. We have different numbers. But the 6-module plant will produce 462 megawatts electric. It's a really good size for coal-fired plant replacements.
To continue with this metaphor, the soda cans, the reactor modules, chill in a cooling pond that is almost entirely below ground, with just the tops of the reactors above the water. And the whole setup fits inside a massive reactor building. NuScale installs the reactors after building them off-site in a factory, on a sort of assembly line.
It's somewhat like the Boeing model for airplanes. You know, you're building these things in a factory. It's a very controlled environment, and you get the benefit of standardized design. We wanted to have the ability to have multiple manufacturers, not just in the U.S., but around the world, who could manufacture these modules.
Building these smaller reactors in a factory reduces costs. It should also reduce the potential for a design error. And here's something I didn't know. Every reactor in the United States is unique, built at different times with different materials. The reactor designs, the control room layout, they're all bespoke, built on site and customized. But with a factory-built standardized design...
Your control room looks the same in these different locations. The parts, all the components are the same and replaceable. And so we can actually replace an entire module or just the upper two-thirds of a module or whatever is needed for different types of maintenance or repairs.
Which should make it easier to fix issues and train people and helps eliminate possible risks. Jose is only too aware of how people perceive nuclear energy.
So one of the things that we did with our design was we said, well, let's see if we can come up with a design so safe that it'll address the public's perception of risk. So we designed a nuclear plant such that in terms of safety, under the worst case conditions, the reactor will safely shut itself down without any operator action, without any AC or DC power, and without the need to add water to keep it cooled for an unlimited period of time.
Then, he says, NuScale went a step further with their design. The general public thinks about risks in terms of the consequences, even if there's the infinitesimally small chance of a meltdown. And honestly, we haven't even come close to one in the United States since 1979. What happens if that comes to pass?
So we did the analysis further, and we found that under the worst-case conditions, you have a 1-in-a-billion-year event. The consequences were zero. We don't exceed regulatory doses at the site boundary. Even if you do have an event, there's no impact outside the fence of the plant. And so that's a huge, huge step forward.
NuScale has been working on this project for over 20 years. And now, in partnership with the Department of Energy and a group of utility companies, the first small modular reactor is slated to start producing power in 2030. And where will this be built? At the Idaho National Laboratory, of course. The site. And Idaho Falls will be one of the towns on the receiving end of that newfangled atomic energy. This season of Wild Thing is supported solely by First Light Capital Group. Founded by female entrepreneur Alba Toll, First Light Capital Group is an innovative investment firm that strives to generate outstanding financial returns and change how the industry fosters talent and diversity. First Light has a dual-pronged mission. First, it trades public equities, private equities, and debt using its proprietary data-informed investment process. And second, through a separate seed fund, it seeks to cultivate the next generation of female entrepreneurs by providing women-led businesses in the technology and biotechnology sectors with the capital, infrastructure support, and mentorship needed to take their companies to the next level. To learn more about First Light Capital Group, please visit firstlightcapitalgroup.com. Wild Thing fans, I have a serious message for you. If you're not already talking to your kids about aliens, it's probably time to start. Just this year alone, the James Webb Space Telescope found distant planets that might harbor life. Archaeologists claimed to have found mummified aliens, and extraterrestrials even got a shout out during congressional hearings. No doubt your kids are asking lots of questions, and it could be you're not sure how to answer them. Let me recommend my new book, Is There Anybody Out There?, which arrives on Earth on October 3rd. This middle grade book, based on season 2 of Wild Thing, explores the question of whether we're alone in the universe using science, humor, and fun illustrations. And it'll leave everyone better prepared for the possibility of alien life. Help kids learn how to tell the difference between science fact and science fiction. Look for Is There Anybody Out There in all bookstores and online. Or for more information, go to wildthingpodcast.com. It's no surprise that supporters of nuclear energy argue that it's inherently safe, that we have learned from past mistakes, and we're improving the technology to a point where accidents are unlikely to either occur or cause serious harm. At the Idaho National Laboratory, the former National Reactor Testing Station, and the site of the SL-1 accident, scientists are considering how we might make things safer by getting people out of the picture.
That's where I kind of see the future of nuclear power, right, is trying to drive towards that kind of solution. That removes humans from the equation.
Aaron Balsmeyer is taking me on a tour of the site. He works with the lab's National Reactor Innovation Center as a nuclear facility engineer, collaborating on the next generation of nuclear reactors, technology that he hopes will help us avoid situations like those we've experienced in the past.
Chernobyl happened because of bad management and mistakes, right? Or Fukushima happened because management didn't pay for an upgrade that they needed. If you can remove that human error by having an inherently safe design, then you don't have to worry about it.
Aaron is currently working on what are called microreactors. When he said this, I immediately thought back to those early days in the 1940s and 50s, when we thought our cars and homes would be powered by individual tiny reactors. Aaron quickly dashed my Jetsons dreams. The reactors are small, but not that small. But they are meant to be mobile.
If you can make a reactor small enough, you could take it to a remote location, either civilian or military, and have basically an infinite supply of electricity. I say infinite, it's not exactly true, right? But whereas your diesel generator, if you have a big tank, you'll run out in a month. A nuclear reactor, you might run out in 5 years.
The military, specifically the Army, has expressed interest in this technology too. Similar to their earlier dreams for SL-1, the Army sees these microreactors as a way to power distant bases.
And they say, instead of taking a whole bunch of diesel and constantly resupplying it, you could take a reactor in a container or something like that and run it and have lots of electricity for a long period of time.
Getting diesel to remote bases has been tricky for the military. Studies show that of the 36,000 U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan between 2003 and 2011, over 50% came from attacks on resupply lines. So you can see why the military would love to avoid that problem. Or think about the aftermath of huge natural disasters, like Hurricane Katrina, or the earthquakes in Haiti, or the ice storms in Texas. State officials or the military could fly a small reactor in and attach it to the grid, providing emergency power to things like hospitals. Aaron is enthusiastic about nuclear power. I mean, it is his job, so I would expect nothing less. When I ask him if we can truly be safe about it, his answer is unequivocally positive.
The answer is yes, and we're standing at a place where they did this. This was formerly EBR-2, Energy Breeder Reactor 2, or as it was also called, is the integral fast reactor. This was a safe shutdown reactor. You couldn't cause it to blow up. You couldn't melt it down, right? And if you can't melt it down, then you can't have the reactor accident, right? They actually ran a test in the early 90s on this reactor. They basically took it up to where you would start to see an accident happen, let go, and the reactor physics, this inherent physics of it, turned it off.
If it's so safe, then why did they shut the program down and dismantle the reactor? A little problem called plutonium. We haven't talked a lot about plutonium. It's a natural element that doesn't really exist in nature anymore. But some kinds of nuclear reactors, breeder reactors, create it as a byproduct. We've mostly used it for nuclear weapons, but it's also a nuclear reactor fuel in and of itself. Some countries do use it as such, but here in the U.S., we don't. It's a bit of a political hot potato, and a lot of people worry that terrorists could get their hands on it to create dirty bombs. So breeder reactors, like the one Aaron is talking about, aren't in operation anymore.
Some people are just uncomfortable with nuclear because they'll tell you a number of reasons. I disagree, and that I think we can do this stuff safely. We've demonstrated it.
Of course, someone who works in nuclear power is going to say that. It's like the guy who works at the restaurant telling you that everything on the menu is great. You want to believe him, but can you? But Aaron has one last, in my opinion, very good point.
People look at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima and say those are reasons not to do this, right? And while those are horrible things to have happened, they were preventable. Take the United States Navy. They've got something like 6,500 reactor years of operation without a nuclear accident.
The Navy has operated reactors since the 1950s, without incident. Part of that has to do with the man who established the nuclear Navy to begin with, Admiral Hyman Rickover. We briefly heard about him back in episode 3. Rickover was what some people might call a control freak. He personally interviewed every last officer in the Navy's nuclear program and oversaw the construction and operation of more than 100 nuclear-powered ships, including the famed USS Nautilus, the world's first nuclear submarine. This was a man who, when a single error was found in a prototype Navy reactor, one that wasn't even using any radioactive materials yet, forced his men to rip the whole thing apart and rebuild it. In fact, Rickover was so appalled by what happened with the Army's SL-1 reactor that he actually hired his own investigator, a nuclear engineer, to go to Idaho and find out the details of what went wrong. The findings likely resulted in Rickover scrutinizing all the Navy's reactors to make sure there were no similar flaws. He was not a man to leave things to chance, and good enough was definitely not good enough. Rickover recognized just how terrifying nuclear energy could be, and considered it a necessary evil. Surprising for a man whose career was built on nuclear power. At one point, he was quoted as saying,
"The whole reactor game hangs on a much more slender thread than most people are aware. There are a lot of things that can go wrong, and it requires eternal vigilance."
He demanded perfection from everyone in what he would likely consider his program. A program that hasn't, knock on wood, ever had an accident. So it can be done. But for many people, the risks, no matter the probability, still seem too high. And as we learned earlier, advocates for nuclear energy can throw facts and figures at people all day long, and it won't change their minds. So, would anything make nuclear seem less risky? What if you had something equally risky to compare it to?
Climate change.
Climate change.
We all need to be concerned about climate change.
Nuclear energy as a way to deal with climate change. Coming up on the next episode of Wild Thing. To learn more about the events around Three Mile Island, check out Natasha Zaretsky's book, Radiation Nation, Three Mile Island and the Political Transformation of the 1970s. And for premium subscribers, we'll also have an extended bonus interview with her later this season. Premium subscribers get each episode early and exclusive access to all bonus episodes, not to mention the warm, fuzzy feeling that comes from supporting the show. For more information, go to wildthingpodcast.com. That's Wild Thing Podcast, all one word. You'll also find out more about this season, including how to get Wild Thing t-shirts and stickers. Links to the website and the shop are also on social media, at Wild Thing Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Also, please consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts, and definitely tell your friends. All of this really helps get the word out about the show and makes future seasons more likely. This podcast is a production of Foxtopus, Inc., with generous support from First Light Capital. Wild Thing is edited by Alicia Lincoln, with sound mixing and music from Louis Weeks. Our executive producer is Scott Carney, and I'm your host and creator, Laura Krantz.